Thank you, Heather. I also have to mention that I have a MPH from the University of North Carolina, and they tried to charge me out-of-state tuition because I had gone to Duke. I'm going to talk about protecting American healthcare consumers and patients under health reform using a human rights approach. Oops. The thesis of this talk, as you can see laid out there, is that we have a lot to learn. Well, I'm kind of commenting on the thesis. I don't read slides. But we have a lot to learn from a human rights approach in terms of how we think about protecting patients and consumers under health reform. And so with this talk, I'm going to talk about how our current law, administrative law, constitutional law, and tort law kind of fall short when you compare them to a human rights approach. And that the trends in these areas of the law for the last 30 years have been sort of opposed or contrary to a human rights approach. They tend to, the law tends to make it harder to sue in torts, harder to get standing, harder to get judicial review on a whole host of fronts. Now, I can only sort of give you a taste of what I'm of the problem here. I'm planning to write a whole book on this issue in my retirement years. But at any rate, I think that we have a lot to learn in our current law that is in place to protect individuals generally, and patients and consumers, as they deal with public agencies, as they deal with corporations and the like. All right, I'm going to look at three fields of law and policy very quickly: constitutional and administrative law, which governs the relationship of individuals to the government; tort law, which redresses civil wrongs not arising in contract; and then human rights, which you will see is a different approach. Current law, constitutional, administrative, are traditional procedural protections for U.S. healthcare consumers and patients. Are they adequate protections? Constitutional law, I blazingly took that from Wikipedia. Well, I think that constitutional law generally has moved away from protecting individuals in our society generally, and in our in healthcare as well. I think we have had a fairly conservative court over the last couple of decades, and we've seen cases that have whittled away at areas of the law that used to be quite beneficial for protecting consumers and patients. In particular, I would point out the procedural due process clause. In the 1970s, when we had Goldberg versus Kelly establish a right to due process in an administrative proceeding such as a welfare benefit, we saw that a lot was guaranteed: a right to an oral hearing, representation by counsel, and so forth and so on. All the trappings of what we might call an evidentiary hearing, what was available to individuals whose welfare benefits were terminated. That was the high water mark. As we moved away from into the 70s, the Supreme Court kind of got nervous about what they had wrought. I think that they had precipitated a revolution, as many people talked about. People in scholarship, after having established the argument that we should have procedural due process with respect to government benefits, then scholarship began to go, whoa, we can't have a trial every time somebody loses, you know, if somebody is denied a Medicaid benefit. And so they've kind of retracted, almost so much so that really what is required as a matter of procedural due process is basically some kind of notice, maybe some kind of hearing. The hearing can be over the telephone. The hearing can be, it does not necessarily represent a trial such as we saw in the early 70s. So that's an area of constitutional and administrative law where we have seen significant retrenchment in the rights to protect patients. Here is the Administrative Procedure Act, a very interesting act, and one that has really served our government well, but we will see that there are instances where it is very hard for individuals to get involved or to bring a case in court if they are unhappy with an agency determination or are unhappy with any kind of government action. And for example, let's take judicial review. This is pretty stern judges here. But we have a required cause of action. In other words, you can't just be unhappy about something. You can't just say that your human rights have been violated. You've got to go to this chest of legal theories and pick out a cause of action. Then we have judicial review. Let me take example two doctrines. Intervention. In the law, we have a procedure where people can intervene in a lawsuit or intervene in an administrative proceeding. And they have to have an interest in order to intervene against, be allowed to intervene against the will of the other parties in the lawsuit. But the ability to intervene over time, the law has constricted on its permissiveness regarding the right to intervention. Standing is a related doctrine. Standing is a doctrine that is one of the six conditions of the availability of judicial review. It's another doctrine that requires that you have to have more goods than just to go to a court and say, I'm steamed up about a policy and I want you to do something about it. Standing is a requirement that you have some skin in the game when it comes to the outcome of the proceeding or the proceeding that you want to bring, and that you also are subject to imminent harm. It's designed to get rid of sort of asking the court to answer hypothetical questions and to get away really from people with a political agenda trying to get the courts to address their political agenda. I've often suspected that there is a relationship on whether a court wants to hear the merits of a case, and if they are not, if they're inclined to rule against parties or not, or that they can really cut a cause of action off at the knees under the standing doctrine. Some of the cases on the constitutionality of the Health Reform Act have been dismissed on the basis that the parties do not have standing. And over the years, the Supreme Court has become much more strict about the rules of standing. And then here we have other doctrines, the ripeness doctrine, pre-enforcement review of rules, and so forth. At any rate, again, doctrines that require you to make a showing before you are able to get through the courthouse door and get the attention of the court to adjudicate your matter. And then another important decision of the 1984 is the Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council case. It was before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in a challenge to an environmental rule brought by the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Supreme Court said, we're not interested in whether the EPA was right. We're interested in whether the EPA was reasonable. And in that case, the Supreme Court kind of sort of carved out a whole space that previously had been available to courts to invalidate policies, rules, policies, and statutes of the like on the grounds that they were not correct from a policy perspective. So the idea of all these limitations on judicial review and the right to intervene in administrative proceedings, the idea is that people should pursue their political agenda in the political branches of government. And what I am afraid of in this country, particularly for healthcare beneficiaries or healthcare patients and consumers, is that the political system has become so corrupted by money and that there are efforts afloat both at law, state law and various activities to suppress the votes of disadvantaged peoples. I am concerned that these political branches for influence on health reform will not be available. And so you'll have this situation where you have all the stakeholders at the table, the pharma, the business, the hospital associations, and what about us down here, the patients and the consumers? Tort. This is another area. This is a lot of people think of lawsuits and liability and torts as kind of a bad thing. The lawsuits can be conducted in ways that may not be desirable. There are lots of problems with the tort system. It's a little bit, people feel that it's a little bit of a lottery. But it is the one area of law where if somebody has behaved against you and exposed you to a reasonably foreseeable risk of injury and has injured you, you have to have the actual injury and damage to recover, then you can go to a court and seek redress. You don't have to go to an agency. You don't have to go. You can go. You can even sue yourself. You probably won't be that successful, but you would be able to get relief. And it is an extraordinary power, and I think a benefit for consumers. And we have, over the last 30 years, in the name of tort reform, really diminished and limited the rights of people to pursue tort remedies if they have been damaged. And I think that if you had the way of much of business, you would have mandated arbitration and contracts. Like, for example, if you have a fight with your credit card company now, you've probably waived your right to tort remedies by signing or by just having the card. It came with that little squiggle piece of paper that comes with the card that you don't read and throw away. So I'm concerned that our law is going in the wrong direction when you talk about a international human right to health. We are going very much in the wrong direction. What are human rights? I think these slides are available, so I won't read them, and you can look at them later if you have insomnia and can't get to sleep. Human rights, in one sense, is a set of international and regional treaties. The foundational document, although not a treaty, is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in Article 25, it refers to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care. The right to security in the event of sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, and it's really quite a radical statement of what people are permitted. Here is the International Covenant for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, again, fairly explicit. You know, we didn't even talk about these rights until the 1980s, late 1970s, early 1980s, when President Carter began to apply a human rights standard to what the different governments were up to. But again, the United States has not signed this particular covenant, and it's only come up in Democratic administrations because I think there is a real ideological, this obligation poses real ideological problems for many Republicans. Constitution of the World Health Organization, this is something the United States has signed on to, and other international treaties, there is a lot of law, hardcore law, if you will, black letter laws, we say in the trade, out there on human rights. We also have domestic legislation and regulation is really where the rubber hits the road when it comes to implementing human rights. I think other speakers are going to talk about implementing human rights on the ground. These are the four areas of health care regulation that would be amenable to a human rights approach. And of note, the General Comment 14 of the Economic and Social Council is quite extensive, if a little disorganized, outlining the right to health. This is a very important document to consider at any point in looking at the right to health and health care. There's the right to health. I'm going to go through these quickly with the idea that you can get this up on the web. I just wanted to let you give you a taste of it and also give you a taste of its complexity. Also, implementation and enforcement. This is really where the rubber hits the road. When it comes to enforcement, we can see the law that I've been talking about, the current law, is moving away from opportunities for individuals to enforce challenges to their human rights. A human rights approach is something that the UN has been developing, and since the reform of the United Nations, and the idea is that you put human rights into you think about human rights into everything that is that the UN does. It's not a separate track. People are not entitled to aid because it's a charitable act. People are entitled to aid because they are human. And a different thing. I think this Louise Arbour in the Frequently Asked Questions on a Human Rights-Based Approach to Development Cooperation, I showed you the title page of that book before. She kind of says it all. And I think it's interesting how she focuses on inequities. And we know we have a problem of inequality in this country. We see changes here in real family income with the top 5%. Just doing so much better than the other categories. But if you had any doubts that there was a problem of inequality in this country, this slide settles the case. This is a $6,400 toilet that has all these bells and whistles. If there is a market for this kind of product, we've got a problem. I mean, the idea that you would even invest in market and develop such a item, I just found this slide in this article in the New York Times astounding. And so what do we have to think about with the Patient Protection Act and a human rights approach? Well, here we are with the Patient Protection Act. We have four major goals. I think you all are familiar with them. But these are the key challenges. How can consumers and patients influence policies and decisions, and how can they seek redress? I have to say that the Patient Protection Act really contains a lot of protections for consumers. And there's lots of opportunities for consumers to be involved with policy boards. I get concerned, though. Let's take the regulations regarding appeals of decisions of the health insurance exchanges at the state level. Sound great in the statute. Then they came out with a proposed rule. The industry went into orbit. They watered it down. At any rate, we haven't come up yet with final regulations, and they get more and more watered down as we see the political machinations of Washington do their work. So this is just, we ought to look at PACA through the lens of a human rights approach, and these are the 10 titles of PACA that should be subjected to this. But I want to just close with one final observation. We have to be very careful not to think about, you know, allowing courts to make budget and political judgments. That's the conundrum I can't figure out. If you have access to courts because people are troubled that they can't get they can't get the care they need, they go to a court and hope that the court will award it. Well, when a court does that, that really influences public policy making and budgetary concerns, and that's a problem. And I don't know how we balance the need to provide provide power to individuals to protect their interests, as and also the need of policymakers to forge good policy and not spend money irresponsibly. So with that, I'll close. Thank you very much, and I look forward to questions.